And good morning, good afternoon. Good afternoon, James. And we're just coming at the beginning of the show, so I'll just introduce the show and put the tops and tails in it, and then I'll bring you right in. Is that okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much. So let me just turn that off. Right. Okay. So welcome. This is the 12th of the 12th, 2016. 5 PST, actually it's the 13th in Britain, and it's 1 AM here in the U of K, but we don't talk about time, because everybody says, oh, you should be so tired, but I'm not really. Because, you know, I live PST. So, this afternoon, I am speaking with Dr. James McCanney. You came in through Keith Roberts a few weeks ago about something that happened a few years ago, and well, we wanted to clear that up. And then I thought, well, you sound pretty much a very interesting fellow anyway, and I've never spoken to you live, so welcome to Journeys, Jim McCanney. James, how can I call you? I mean, people call me JP, right? Because, or Jay, because it's easier. But,
James is fine.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much, James. So, it's an honor to have you on. And, I believe that, you know, you have, your various nuggets of science that I'm kind of interested in the edges of science and what we haven't been told. In the scientific paradigm, I was very pleased to hear that you have a firm foundation in the electric universe theory.
Well, that's actually something I began decades and decades ago, long before the internet, long before anybody popularized it and somewhat took it over. But it's a term I developed. I was at a place called Cornell University in 1979 and was developing my work while the data was coming in. That was a big bastion of NASA, and so I had access to data, and it was really a ripe time to be in the right place at the right time with the right theoretical work and the data coming in to confirm it. And so it was, and that more or less, the concept of electric universe, it's like many things. You, choose something that people will remember. And unfortunately, there's so many people running around today saying electric universe that it's really gotten destroyed, the original intent and meaning of it. By a lot of people who are not even scientists. But anyway, that's, that the entire universe, by the way, that mostly everything we detect and see in the universe is gravitational. The electrical stuff is very subtle, and it's not pervasive as some people would have you believe. It's very subtle, and you have to understand it from a physics point of view. So my background is in physics, and that's what I was working at. I taught physics and mathematics when I was at Cornell. And so half of my career I've been in the university level teaching mathematics, physics, computer science, and astronomy. And then a lengthy part of my career I've been in the telecommunications industry dealing with high-level security, computer systems, etc.
Cool. So on the data level, on the encryption level?
Okay. The 10 years of my 25 years in telecommunications, I worked for a company. We built IBM-compatible, what they're called front-end processors. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it's a computer that offloads the main computing system of telecommunications. So we built large private networks for Shell Oil and the banks and the federal and state governments. We built private networks. And by the way, we never had an issue with hacking. But that's rather modern phenomena. And of course, encryption and firewalls and everything that went with it. We built those. And then I spent another 15 years dealing with a company that managed nationwide computer networks.
Okay.
That's so, a brief summary.
So, I want to put on a serious face and talk about gravity, because this is one of my, one of the things is like what we're told is not the truth. So can we clear up, first of all, what, if you want to talk about gravity, you have to talk about what it is and not what we are taught it is. Could you clear that up for everybody?
Well, there are people saying that gravity is related to electricity, and it's really not true, because gravity works through all of the shielding things. Let's take a step backwards. If you have electrical things and magnetic things, and those are related, you can shield those, so they don't work through your shielding.
That's right.
And we know this from UL and the performance of, you can make electronics so that what's going on in there does not broadcast outside of that. But you cannot do that with gravity. Gravity works through all of the shielding and the ionosphere and all of the other things that absorb and block and reflect and alter electromagnetic radiation. Gravity works through all of this stuff. It works through vacuum. It works through other matter. So it's a really strange and very constant element of our universe.
So it almost exists outside of the universe that we are, because it doesn't obey any of the laws. It's like an outsider, you know?
Yeah. And, so it's a strange thing. And one of the things that Einstein and many other scientists were working on, they call it the unification of the fields, trying to understand the relationship of everything from the short range nuclear forces and other types of forces in the atomic nucleus up to electrical things and the chemical level of atoms and molecules. And then up to large scale universe, and then including gravity. And gravity's always been the sore point. I mean, it's really sticks out like a sore thumb.
I know, it's the nub, and it's very serious, you know.
Yeah.
Because without the I'm joking about grave and serious, but without the knowledge of what gravity is, we can't say anything about the universe, can we?
Well, it's real difficult, and one of the aberrations was when Einstein put forth general relativity, which was heralded immediately by Eddington and a few other astronomers. And as it turns out, Einstein really wasn't very convinced of general relativity himself. And of course, the Minkowski, the transformations and all of the mathematics, high-powered mathematics, got people off into left field very quickly, and they've never come back. But the so-called elevator example is the crux of general relativity. And that amounts to the following. There's, the idea is that there's an equivalence between an inertial accelerating system and a gravitational system. So if you're on the ground, or let's say you start out, you're in an elevator and you're accelerating at 32 feet per second squared, and you do an experiment. You shine a light beam in one side of the elevator, and then you measure where it hits on the other side of the elevator, and because you're accelerating, that's going to look like a parabola, and that light beam will hit below where it would hit on the wall if you were just sitting still, or if you were in an inertial system moving at a constant velocity. So what Einstein said was, well, let's call this the principle of equivalence, and therefore that should happen if you're standing on Earth in a gravitational system with a gravitational acceleration of 32 feet per second squared. But the problem is that the gravitational force to cause this is immense. You have to have things the size of galactic nuclei to even notice it. And so they did some calculations, and Eddington did some experiments. And one thing I discovered was all of those results are really electrical. And there is a relationship between electricity and magnetism and the bending of light and redshifts. And that's one of my main discoveries from back in my early days also. It's called the induced electric dipole redshift. And it shows how light and electromagnetic radiation is affected by non-uniform electric fields. And you can prove it with very simple experiments in the laboratory. And I've done this many times in front of students and classrooms, etc. But so general relativity really isn't true. So this idea that gravity affects light is simply not true. And Einstein understood that. And he tried to stop this freight train of general relativity when he was older, but he couldn't. By that time, it was ran over him and everybody else. And the idea of dark matter and dark energy and this invisible matter that permeates the universe, supposedly, and the expanding universe itself, all of these things are just totally incorrect based on that one little seed that was planted, the principle of equivalence, which has never had experimental verification.
So it's just kind of somebody's had an idea and nobody touches it because if it did, everything would collapse.
Right.
Right. Exactly. So let's start. Let's recreate a foundation of physics then, because it seems just as we speak, we're in the midst of a collapse of government because of we see the corruption of it, and we're seeing it's not just, you know, it's not just the political world, it's the world in Britain at least. We're seeing football and all these stratas of institutional world collapsing. And that also means that our education system is going to need rehauling, because there's lies that have been told that keep their system in place.
Yeah,
even the fact of an educational system in that way is part of the domination system, you know, part of the slave control system, isn't it?
Oh, exactly. The day you walk into kindergarten when you're a little kid or whatever, K-12 or whatever, I'm not sure if they use those terms in England, but K-12 means kindergarten to 12th grade. So those are your formative years. And from the day you walk in the door the first day, you're being programmed. And if you pass the grade, you get an A, and that means you're smart. And so learning what they tell you and spitting it back, regurgitating it, it's training you to believe that you're smart. And if you got lots of A's, you must be really smart. And really, what you've done is you've learned a lot of stuff. 95% of it is not even true. So, yeah, education, and then you get grown people, and you get up to master's and PhD level, and they're the worst of all because they really think they know something. And so then you get the rank and file, and I have an expression that rows and columns of PhDs all saying the same thing does not mean science. That's just a mutual honorarium society for everybody to make sure they're going to continue getting their paychecks.
It's a club.
It's a club.
And as George Collins said, we ain't in it. And so here's the thing. The problem is, as far as I can see, is the nature of the way thinking is formulated in us, in the way that we are taught to think. Because what I'm saying, where I'm coming from is like, everything in this world, particularly in universe world and prove world, is you have to have something material to start with. But when you're talking about forces and fields of stuff that don't have an emanating center, how does physics cope with that? How do you cope with like a plasma cloud that can decide to move left, right, or up or down all by itself?
Well, yeah, plasma physics is one of the most difficult regions and of understanding in standard science. I've really never met anybody in standard science that understands plasma physics, and it's really distorted in what they call electric universe people. It's very, very distorted by people who don't really understand science either. But basically, understanding how, here's the problem. If something moves, then it causes other things to move, and they move and respond at the same time. And all of this is happening simultaneously. So our general way of looking at this is to set up a computer simulation and then try and model this. But there's all kinds of problems with computer simulations. First of all, they're limited. The field of numbers that you have is limited, and every time you multiply two numbers together, there's an error at the end. And when you do this millions and millions of times, all of those errors round up to equal the size of the number itself. So there was a thing generated one time. It was called chaos theory. It was popular about 15 or 20 years ago. And it said all of the orbits of the planets would go chaotic one day all of a sudden, and all the planets would just go flying off into outer space. And it's really not true, because what they were looking at was computer modeling, and they failed to understand that they were actually seeing in the computer models results rounding errors that were accumulating over time.
Here's the thing, James.
James? Go ahead.
The computer models are created by computer programmers who are basically guys with Asperger's. And it's the limitation on their ability to think in the ways that creates the limits for these models. This is my thing. Cause, guess what? I worked at University College London for 10 years, and I was the computer advisor for a lot of the people who were doing all this kind of research and mm-hmm. all sorts of other research, like IRAS and, you know, the infrared satellite. It's kind of, I've got an impression of them that there's a materialistic viewpoint. Yes. Whereas they're, you know, the electric universe is the next octave of thinking upwards from this.
Well, the one thing I've been able to do, and this is, takes a lot of training, and this is the unfortunate thing where you have people that don't have training, those long nights spent doing physics problems, there's no replacement for that. And what you do is you take a physics problem, and if you're sincere about what you're doing, you don't just solve it. You go back and you study it, and you look at the mathematics, and you understand by looking at mathematics how it relates to the physical situation. And you may spend hours on a particular problem. So it takes severe amounts of time. And so for people to walk up and say they're a plasma physicist and they have no background in all of this that you have to go through to become trained, and then you have to study the history of science and know what standard science says. And then what I did was I developed my own physics principles, and it was based on a very sound physics background and mathematics background. I have a double degree in mathematics and physics. So in what's interesting in standard science, most astronomers and space scientists have very little physics background and less mathematics. They probably took physics 1, 2, and 3 in, you know, freshman and sophomore year of college, and that's the last physics they ever took. They didn't take thermodynamics, they didn't take electromagnetism, they didn't take and so then they went off into astronomy land and learned all of the basic theories of astronomy and thought that they were smart, and not never understanding that, you know, everything they were learning from that point on was pretty much incorrect based on 1950s concepts like the dirty snowball comet model and the dust collapsing into a solar system model, and, you know, on and on and on. So, yeah, what we're dealing with is a lot of very untrained people out there walking around spouting things that don't know what they're talking about. And like I say, it's very subtle, the things that happen. That's what my work does, is it puts all of this into perspective. Like, they just take galactic formation, for example. It's a purely gravitational process. It has nothing to do with electricity, but once you get the nucleus formed and it starts, the fusion starts, then you have the electrical things start kicking in, but even those are very subtle. And gravity dominates the gravitational force dominates galactic construction. And even in solar systems, gravity dominates. The majority of time, people are talking about, oh, this planet flew over here, and now it was up at the North Pole of Earth, and then it flew out to where it was, and, you know, not understanding that those things are not even possible. You know, so there's a lot of misinformation, unfortunately. It's really difficult for the general public to sort all of this out.
Absolutely. And, you know, because we've had trouble with yeah, electromagnetic waves, okay? So we can see the wave in a sea, and the wave in the ocean, and wave on a pond, and wave in, you know, ripples in a cup or a bowl. So we see what a wave is, but we're only actually looking at the effects of a wave. It's, there's something else going on. It's like you're looking at a two-dimensional effect of a three, four-dimensional event. So when you're talking about, you know, a solar system, okay, or a galaxy, I mean, when I look at these things, I think, well, the way they're depicted, they all look the same as, you know, a planet and its moons, a solar system and its planets, a galaxy and its arms. To me, they all have a similar kind of action event thing that is going on a macro and micro scale. And that's the, oops, somebody's calling you. The basis of my kind of, universal view, if you like, that mm-hmm. everything is similar and it just goes all the way down, back down to the atom and probably further. Is that the reality, or is the universe, does it behave differently in other places? Am I making sense? Is that a valid universal model?
Well, yeah. And every time we dig deeper into, say, atomic structure or something like that, people come up with better ways of modeling it. You know, we had the Bohr atom, and that broke down, and then you have quantum mechanics, and then that breaks down. But I wrote a book called The Diamond Principle. And one of the concepts there is it starts out by talking about diamonds. And if you found a diamond on the far side of the universe, would it have the same properties as diamonds here? And the answer is yes, because the formative process of diamonds is the same, or whatever those processes are. And so even though you would never find two diamonds that look alike, even on Earth or if you search the whole universe, but the question is, if you were the first guy to discover a diamond, you dug it up and you go, wow, this is a diamond. This is really beautiful. Would you think that you had the only one in the universe? Or would you keep digging to find more? And I think the average person would say, well, you keep digging to find more. And as you find more, and then as you become learned and you understand that there's other planets out there and the universe is big and there's other galaxies and way on the other side of the universe, there's other galaxies. Would you imagine that there are going to be diamonds over there that are the same? And the answer really is yes. But then you start getting into things like DNA and life, which is, in a sense, really strange. Why isn't everything just inorganic? I mean, just rock and stone. But we have this ability that these same nucleotides and combinations of very simple atoms of oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen, when they come together, they work the same way here. And so the DNA in my left little finger is the same as the flower out there, is the same as in your left finger, and is the same as across the universe. These are just like the diamond. They are processes. And these naturally form these molecular groups, and then they start building together. So should we expect bipedal, symmetrical people with two eyes on the other side of the universe? Yeah, or trees. that grow up because they want to get up to where the light is shining in. So all of these things, we're not going to find oak trees probably on other planets, but we're going to find trees and plants and some kind of people or creatures, you know, so it's complicated. And then you get the intelligent life, which is different than the dog or the cat who just goes around their daily life and, you know, does the basic things. Intelligent life has the ability to shape your environment and to think and look it up at the stars. How many dogs look up at the stars and go, gee, look at all those stars. I wonder what's going on up there, and start doing physics problems. Just doesn't happen. You know, so there's something, different levels, and then you start getting up to higher spiritual levels, and, you know, so it's complicated. I mean, we're dealing with the universe, so that's why it makes me angry when people come along and try and pretend like they know so much. Like, I don't think we know very much at all. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface here.
So how is my model? So there's the electric model as opposed to the mass model. This is where I'm trying to get to. Then it takes us into like holographic universe as well. Like we're all in a holodeck and it's like a kind of simulation and all this stuff. And in a way it's like, okay, you throw a bunch of physics students into an environment and you tell them, okay guys, figure out what the rules to this what are the rules to this universe? What are the physics rules to this universe? Here, I'll give you, you know, 5 million years to figure that out. And you throw them down into this place and they do all sorts of experiments and eventually build, reactors and all kinds of machines to measure things. Do you think that's the game? Is it like that? Is it a game? Like a video game?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, curiosity and just noticing things like, you know, Newton noticing that light changed when it went through glass and noticing that, oh, okay, if you make it in the shape of a prism, you can separate the light. So white light is made up of these various, spectrum of colors. And, it's the same as the rainbow. And so that the water droplets are doing the same thing, but it's a back reflection. It's not a pass through. Anyway, yeah, you just start noticing things and putting all this together. So that's what a physics student does, is spends many, many, many years picking all this apart and going through textbooks. And then it eventually, here's the interesting part, you get out on the, once you have your background, which like I say, there's a lot of people running around that don't have that and trying to spout off about things. But once you have a solid background, then you have to start projecting out. And that's when you're out on the cutting edge. And I know what it's like to be on the cutting edge, because the real symptom is that you don't have anybody to talk to when you're doing work, or like I broke the prime number problem, the direct calculation of prime numbers. There's nobody to talk to. You have to be self-correcting. And this comes from experience. I mean, when you're on the cutting edge, you can't look up on the internet and see if you're doing it right, or look at the back of the book and see if you did the problem right. There's nobody to ask. So you have to take those years of experience of self-correcting and self-monitoring and discipline to move forward and know that what you've done, okay, now what I've got here is good, now I'm going to the next level. So that's when you know that you're out and breaking new ground.
And the effect, I mean, really it's the effect of what you know, why does that make us better? Which is, how do we put this information to good use? How can we improve the world through the correct universal model?
Right, right. Instead of making atomic bombs with nuclear energy, how can we do something useful?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
You know, and there's people that have the opposite mentality. They'll take a kitchen knife or or a inert object over there and turn it into a weapon. Everything has to be made into a weapon. And then how do you most effectively make a weapon? And, you know, and then there's some of us that don't think that way. You know, I want to figure out how the universe works. And one thing I've realized is that people have that mentality, never get to the real subtle, the real subtleties of the universe. They can create physics and engineering, but that's as far as they get. They don't really get to the point that in nature, this is what I've figured out, because I've designed some electromagnetic propulsion systems, for example, that don't require rockets. They're non-inertial. In other words, they don't burn something and spit it out a nozzle. And so what I realized is you only get to that level of discovery when you have a certain respect for the universe, when you have a certain respect for what you're going to do with science. So, you know, it's, yeah, so having a ethics or a moral, that's something a guy named Tesla had very high moral standards. And I don't see that in science today. Everybody's, you know, going to get an A and they're going to try and do this or get their first job. And I don't see ethics and morals permeating science at all.
No, it's about contention and competition. And basically it's who gets the funding, and the those who get the funding don't often get aren't often funded by the people who have our best global interests at heart, if you like. But
absolutely.
I have loads of questions pouring in. So can I pile them on you? Or sort of at least feed them to you gently in bite-sized chunks?
Sure.
Sure. So they were from all over the world. Here's, from Vilnius. This is from Jeff. Dr. McCanny, are there still simple thought experiments and simple physical experiments to be done which might reveal features of relativity and quantum reality? Or is it all complex 11th dimensional string theory now which can't be verified except by specialists every once in a while?
The old German term for that is Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. And, it's very much alive and well. To be a good scientist, you have to go into that realm of never, never land, but you have to have enough sense, common sense, to bring yourself back also. And this is something that's been totally lost when you get to string theory and the theory of everything and general relativity and cosmology. People have just gone into never, never land. And yeah, so there's on a particular esoteric topic, there might be 10 professors someplace scattered around the world working on this particular thing. And they have a jargon and a terminology library that they've developed that only they can talk together. Well, you know, you have to bring that back. And so the idea of thought experiments is something that's very necessary, because that brings you back to reality, that grounds, there's a grounding there. So that means you, what you're doing has to have a foothold on reality also.
That's the problem is, again, you know, it has to be grounded. So if we can't, I mean, it then brings us to another kind of, priesthood level of separating humanity, those that understand this stuff and those who don't get it. And that can always be a little bit, how can I say, that can be easily weaponized. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I try to, you know, give people inroads into understanding how the universe really works. So it's always good to talk to people. So, back to something really quite, something that most people can't actually detect, but scientists and physicists have built instruments to do so. And this is from True Magic, from Dottie. Can James tell us anything about the incoming energy wave coming in from Cygnus? Cygnus 404. Do you know anything about this? this is something that there's some wave that's battering the back of our heliosphere?
Well, there again, and now is this the one, if I'm not mistaken, they're claiming that it might be something altered by intelligent life, or they're trying to, is that the one? Is there a way to communicate and see if that's what they're talking about?
I'm not sure if that's really what they're talking about. This is something that has been, it's been happening for a while. There's all these magnetometers in satellites, and there's this anomaly where there's an impact that is coming not from the sun, as expected. And it's coming from the direction of Cygnus. You've not heard about this?
No.
Okay. In that case. No. So then there's this...
There's so many things going on. And right now I'm very involved in some projects that are really down to earth, dealing with energy and water filtration. So I don't, with the weather, I try and keep up with all of these fields that I'm involved in. But unfortunately, I don't hit all of the topics, so apologize for that.
Okay, so this is a space weather feature. Anyway, so here's another question from CC the Ape. Gravity is a weak force. Electrical force is much stronger than gravity. The planet's displacement can be modeled accurately by magnetic displacement, a feature of electricity. How do you quantify the universe being dominated by gravity? Is gravity faster than the speed of light? And do you believe in Birkeland currents through the plasma? I have no idea what you just said. Do you get any of those questions?
Okay, let's kind of go backwards here. So starting with Birkeland currents, what Birkeland did, and he was one of the great pioneers, is he noticed in photography, in an observation in outer space that there were signatures of electrical currents. And so, but to have an electrical current, you need a battery. You need a source and a sink, and you need a reason for that electrical current to be there. And that's what Birkeland did not have. So when people talk about Birkeland currents, they're observations of electrical things happening, but you have to understand what the source is, and that's one thing that I spent a lot of time studying, because I noticed electrical currents and cometary activity. And so that was one of the things I worked on very early in my career. So what I did is I identified where these currents come from, and they all come from the same source. It's the fusion, whether it's a galactic nucleus or a quasar or a larger scale process or our own sun, or whether it's Jupiter or Saturn, which have active fusion also. It's a proton wind, and so what you have is an excess current of proton that's coming out of the fusion engine, and it creates a capacitor, and that's where these currents come from. So like I say, Birkeland observed the effects of electrical currents. But they don't just happen by themselves. And then, as far as gravity, once again, magnetic fields, electric fields, you can shield. And they're in the outer space, they're very, very short-lived and short-ranged. And for example, Earth's magnetic field has a sheath that blocks our magnetic field from being detected very far away at all. And it's about 35,000 miles to the sunward side, and it extends a bit farther behind us. But magnetic fields and electric fields are shielded. In fact, that's one of the reasons why what I call my plasma discharge comet model, that's why it works, is because when you have the overall discharge of a capacitor that's formed by the fusion process, then it's like the backyard bug killer. You take a bug and it flies in between these electrically charged plates, and the plates always discharge where the bug is. And if there's no bug, it doesn't discharge. And the solar system is the same way. So once that discharge starts to happen in the plasma that surrounds the fusion object, which in our solar system is the sun, all of the planets are doing that. But gravity, the gravity of Earth, of the Jupiter, of Mercury, of all the planets, of the sun, works through all of this. And if it were related to magnetism or electricity, our gravity would be changing all the time because these electrical currents are changing, the extent of our shielded magnetic field changes, and you can't detect our magnetic field very far out in outer space. So gravity is not related to magnetism or electricity because it works the same no matter what's going on. Whether we're having a big electrical storm or we're involved in a solar storm, that doesn't change our orbit. The thing that does change our orbit is where we have a big influx of material due to an electrical discharge. And that influx of material, once again, is a mechanical thing. It's Newton's second law. You know, if you're pulling in matter, then the Earth is being pulled back towards that matter. And that's where the change comes in, not from magnetic fields, etc.
So it's like a Venturi effect, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like you're being drawn into the vortex rather than being sucked by a magnet. You see this?
The electric and the magnetic fields in outer space are very short-lived. And this is why, by the way, one of the big criticisms, and this is why the people in electric universe can't defend themselves very well amongst standard science, is because they're presenting these ideas, but there's a problem you do. It's called Chapman physics. Chapman was a guy on the American side. He believed that there were no electrical currents in outer space. He believed in neutral universe. And there's a very basic physics problem. I've done it in grad school. Other people have done it. It's very standard. That if you take a charge out in outer space and you just put it there and there's a plasma there, it doesn't have to be uniform plasma, it doesn't have to be, it's just a plasma. It's charged particles and electrons that are free, and you put that charged particle out there, I mean within seconds, that thing is neutralized and has a space charge sheath around it, and you can't see it very far away electrically. You can't detect the properties of that electric or magnetic field, and whether it's electrical or magnetic, it's the same thing. So this happens so quickly that people have come to the conclusion there cannot be any electrical or magnetic activity in outer space. But that's what I discovered, is that the electrical conditions are caused by the electric fields, non-uniform electric fields, not just electric fields, but they're non-uniform. And that's one of the keys. Because you have these central fusion objects that separate charge. For example, the sun has a sea of relativistic electrons around it. It's called the corona. And scientists can't figure out where that comes from. It's like millions of degrees relativistic electrons. And in a gravitational world, that shouldn't be there. But there again, that's the sun is acting as an atomic structure with a positive core and then these electrons going around like a superatom. And so, and then that electron shield, which is the corona, that's what accelerates the protons that come out and they open up holes, and that's the solar wind. So it's a process that I describe in my books, and it's relatively complicated. There are other people who say, well, no, the sun is acting like an anode, and the Birkeland currents are coming in and making it light up like a light bulb. Well, that's great, but how does this magical current keep going on forever and ever? And why doesn't it hit the planets on its magical way into the sun? You know, there's about 20 questions that don't have answers with that model. So in an electrical circuit, you need a closed circuit. Electricity doesn't just flow between two points indefinitely. It might happen for a couple seconds or a short time, but it doesn't keep going on and on and on. You need a battery to keep driving it. So what creates the battery? And so those are all physics problems, and you have to resolve those, and that's what I resolved in my work, understanding that the fusion engines are the source of the electrical stuff. But even comet nuclei, as small as they are primarily dominated by gravity.
Okay.
The comet itself is electrical. The whole shape that we see around the comet is electrical. But the orbit of the comet, the only thing that's changing the orbit of the comet is when it pulls in material with electrical forces. it's not the electrical force that's changing the comet orbit. It's the fact that it's pulling stuff in, and that stuff is pulling back on the comet nucleus and changing its orbit. So it's, like I say, this is subtle. And the electric fields of a comet, you know, if you're outside that containment sheath, you cannot detect the electric field. You can see electromagnetic radiation coming out, but the magnetic and electric fields are shielded.
So here's the thing.
At a very relatively short distance.
So here's the puzzle for me, certainly, and probably for lots of people, is the sheath. This apparently quite hard or impermeable structure that exists simply as the difference between what I'm holding and what the universe around me is holding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, now the other
What is the nature of the sheath? That's the question. What's the sheath and how does it work?
Well, if you're negatively charged, you're going to have positive charge around you very quickly. If you're acting like a magnet, you're going to have magnetic things happening around you very quickly that neutralize you at a distance, because it's just the way the universe works. And these are called sheaths. They're literally called sheaths. The Earth has many sheaths. We have a 5-layer magnetic field around Earth. It starts with the geomagnetic field in the Earth, but that's, if you're standing on the Earth with a compass, that's your dominant magnetic field. But if you go up a ways, the dominant magnetic field is the space plasma sheet that's around the ionosphere. And we have 3 electrical currents that flow around the Earth. 2 flow easterly in the northern and the southern hemisphere, and the equatorial sheath flows westerly. It's primarily electrons. And so those couple, that's another layer of magnetic field, and they couple with the Van Allen belts, which is the next layer out, relativistic protons and electrons, once again moving in opposite directions. And those couple with a larger scale magnetic field that couples out with the solar wind that it comes by. So the answer is that if you're electrical, you're going to have both magnetic and electrical shielding built up very quickly that neutralize you in a free plasma situation. And that's why the Chapman physics people don't believe that space can be electrically active, because this happened so quickly. But what they fail to realize is that the sun produces an electric field by way of its fusion. Jupiter does. Saturn does. When the Voyagers went by Jupiter, they detected the proton winds coming up off of Jupiter. And I knew that because I was in the meetings when the data was coming in when I was at Cornell. I could see this, and they're going, where's this proton wind coming up off of Jupiter? What's that all about? And there's many, many other experiments that went along with that, like the redshift in the Marconi oscillator that was doing the signaling, the telemetry signaling back to Earth, redshifted when it got to Jupiter. And that's because the induced electric dipole redshift. And when that happened, I said it's going to be even bigger at Saturn, which it was. And there's no reason for it, a Marconi oscillator, electromagnetic oscillator, to redshift near something as small as Jupiter or Saturn.
Okay.
So anyway, the long, subtle experiments that happened, and the benefit of me being there when this happened is I could see the data coming in. The scientists tried to scuttle the data because they didn't know what it meant. But I happened to be putting all this together as this data was coming in. I was working and solving these problems. And this is very related to the plasma discharge comet model, the discharges that occur when something comes in and discharges the solar capacitor.
Exactly. So, and this is the whole thing is the cometary behavior and, the behavior of these sheaths. These are like the cell walls around our nuclei.
Exactly. Yeah, they are electrical and magnetic Yeah, cell walls. They literally set up. One of my early papers, this is when I was in the mathematics department at Cornell, it was called Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. And I could see by the way the rings faded on Saturn that there had to be moons in there that were sweeping out these ring systems. And believe me, at that time, nobody on the planet or any place near had any concept that there could be moons in the rings of Saturn. And I got that paper published, and it's, I mean, they found all the moons I predicted. I predicted exactly the orbits they would have. Because I understood that Saturn was a fusion-based object, it had its proton wind, and that these moons would be acting like little comets discharging the proton wind capacitor of Saturn. So, you know, back to the question one listener asked about the Gedanken experiments. That's a perfect example of a thought experiment, knowing that there were moons around Saturn in the gaps of the rings before anybody had the ability to see them, because they're little. They're, you know, under 100 miles across, and the telescopes at that time had no ability to see them, and I predicted them, and when the Voyagers got out there, there they were. They discovered all of them, plus more.
Fantastic. And so what I think I'm trying to get what you're saying is that Saturn, for instance, is behaving as a small scale version of a galaxy that we observe from apparently billions of light years away. And we're saying that they're billions of light years away because they appear to, they have a color, that is associated with it. But what you're saying is that that color is actually something to do with the boundary layer that we've been talking about. Is that correct? Am I getting it somewhere? That Saturn is like a micro galaxy and it's being redshifted, and that's why the rings are different colors.
Well, it's not so much redshifting, but it's the moons were discharging the local capacitor. They were charging up and they were drawing in the material from the rings. And you could see that the rings were faded on the inner edges and not faded on the outer edges. And so it was a characteristic of this electrical comet condition. And the other thing is understanding that what happened to Jupiter was very similar. And that another thing here is that all of these objects had been captured. They didn't form all at the same time, and part of the capture process is the fact that when these comet activities start, it's the drag of the tail on the nucleus that causes these things to fall into circular orbits. So, I mean, there's many, many aspects to this complex theory. But the whole situation, Jupiter has rings, Saturn has more complex rings. It turns out that Saturn is a much more intense little star than Jupiter is. It puts out a lot more energy for its size than Jupiter does. Jupiter is kind of an old hulk of a star, but still active. And all of these things, one thing I say is that the sun, the planets, comets, Jupiter, the moons of Jupiter, the Saturn, the moons of Saturn, all of these are acting like comets because they're all sitting in a proton wind supported capacitor. And so you have all of these, the moons are acting within Saturn's own capacitor. They're blocked from being involved in the wider scale solar system capacitor because they're hovering around in Saturn's capacitor. And that's kind of like this cell concept where Saturn is protected. The stuff outside can't detect the electric fields inside Saturn, but the things inside that field are very active, working with Saturn's own electric field. So it's like, you know, the fleas and the back of a dog on the planet Earth, which is in the middle of, you know, one of those things. There's many levels to what's going on. And so even the star systems in the galactic arms, we see this, and this is getting back to Birkeland currents. When the galactic nucleus has a fusion reaction, Looks like we're here.
All right, yeah, we've got a hard break for about 5 or 6 minutes. Go and get a nice cup of tea, and I'll meet you back on the other side. Thank you very much, James McKenney. We're talking about the mechanics and the physics of the universe. I love this stuff. And welcome back to Journeys with JP. Is that all right? Is it my mic? Is it me or is it my mic? I sound a bit dull today. Hang on. Let's have a bit more upper mid. There we go. This is Journeys with JP. This is myself. And I'm on this afternoon with Dr. James McKenney. You were just right in the middle of your thought. Did you manage to keep a pin in it all that time?
Yes, I did. I just wanted to finish this thought because a Birkeland curve has come up many times when we're talking about things like the topic tonight. And typically they're seen out in the galaxy amongst stars and star fields. And you can see them lighting up like a light bulb, literally, and the gas fields around the stars and the plasma fields. So the question is, where do these currents come from? And the thing was, that's what Birkeland saw, was he, and also atmospheric, you know, like Hans Albin. They were witnessing these and trying to understand, but the thing that they didn't understand at that time was the solar wind and the fusion star and the excess current of protons in the solar wind and the fusion-based capacitors and all those things that I discovered in my work. And the galactic nucleus is acting just the same. So you have this gravitational structure, which is the gravitational, the arms of the nucleus, and the gravity sees through the all of the electrical things that are going on. But the point is that the galactic nucleus is also involved in a fusion reaction and has a very powerful proton wind that stretches really outside the extent of what we see as the galaxy. And that's why when galaxies get close, you start to see that electrical interaction. Or when quasars get close, a quasar is nothing more than a small active galaxy that really hasn't gotten the arms developed yet, but these will get close together and you start to see them interact electrically. But the Birkeland currents are simply the current sheets that are flowing down the galactic arms where the majority of stars are because of the proton wind supported capacitor of the fusion engine, which is at the galactic nucleus. And so it just, this whole concept repeats and repeats and repeats. But like I said, you have to, you can't just talk about Birkeland currents like they just are there and are magically there. And, you know, you have to identify the source of electricity.
Yeah, it's a thing. They're going from somewhere, coming from somewhere, right, and going right in something. And so there's a lot more things that need to be identified before you can say, oh, that's just to this. You can't, right, yeah, right. So Birkeland, I mean, just by slapping a name on it doesn't really define it.
Right, or double layer or any of these things, it doesn't mean anything unless you identify the physics, or like the electrical nature of storms and hurricanes and tornadoes. Once again, you have to identify the source and the entire electrical circuit that's driving these. And that's, I have a book called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, which was really written for the general public. It's my biggest book. It's about 300 plus pages, but it describes the processes of weather on Earth and then on the other planets. Like the Great Red Spot of Jupiter is a hurricane, and many spots on Saturn the same, and they're the same as hurricanes on Earth. But there's a difference there that they don't have land masses on those big gas planets to short the storms out. And so, you know, there's a whole process, but once again, you have to identify the sources of energy. You just can't talk about these in a vacuum without, because if not, they're like somebody all dressed up and no place to go. You need to complete the entire circuit of the source of energy, and that's what I did. And so then you identify these processes. And here's a very subtle example of something I discovered in my earlier work, and that is, it's called the charge-to-mass ratio. An electron has a charge-to-mass ratio, and you can put a number on it. But a proton, which has a positive charge, electron has a negative charge, the proton has the opposite but equal charge, but it has a mass nearly 2,000 times that of an electron. So if you take a proton and you take an electron and nothing else, this is a Gedanken experiment, a great one, and you have just a proton and you set them there and you take the pins out and you let them go, the proton is going to move 1/2,000th the distance that the electron is going to move. The majority of movement is going to be by the electron. So this is why you see in outer space. Now let's do this with a dust particle, or let's do it with a big hydrocarbon molecule. The hydrocarbon molecule is 100,000 times the mass of the electron, but it has one positive electron charge on it, and the electron has its one little negative electron charge, but it's the same charge, equal and opposite of that on the big hydrocarbon molecule. Now let them go and let them see what happens. And the electron will do the vast majority of the traveling here in that big molecule, will hardly move at all. Now let's take a dust particle that's billions of times more massive than an electron and let the one electric positive charge on the dust particle, what's going to happen? The electron is going to do, you know, the vast majority of the movement. So the end result is when you're dealing with plasmas, the vast majority of current charge is in the form of electrons, but you don't see electrons. They're not visible. So the vast majority of stuff going on out there electrically, you don't see. And it's shielded. And you, even if you're pretty close, you can't detect it. So it's complicated. Like I say, these are subtle things, but those are the currents, that electron currents that are forming the Birkeland visible things lighting up, just like in your neon light bulb. You have a current of electron moving through, bumping into these molecules in your neon tube, causing them to illuminate, and that's what causes the light. And so, but you don't see the electrons. So it, you know, there's a lot to this. There's a lot to this. But once again, you have to identify the source of energy, because this stuff just doesn't keep going on forever by itself.
I'm also led to, you know, we're talking about the size of the proton, the size of the electron. I'm also thinking about the size of the ovum and the size of the sperm cell and the size of a star against the size of a planet.
Mm-hmm.
Are these, again, proportional galactic coincidences, or are they part of the model?
Well, there's a size distribution in our solar system. We have one big sun. You know, Jupiter is 1/10 the diameter. So it's certainly, you could put, you know, many, many Jupiters within the sun, and Jupiter is the biggest planet. Then Earth is 1/10 the diameter of Jupiter. So those are just kind of average scales. And then our moon is, you know, much smaller than Earth, et cetera. But so there's one big thing. We've got four kind of big planets. Then we've got lots of other smaller planets. And now there's hundreds of them that they've discovered. And then there's lots of small moons. And then if you look at the really small moons, there's thousands of them, and then you go all the way, once you get down to dust particles, you know, it's astronomical numbers. So there's a size distribution. But this is the interesting thing. The effects of the sun on everything else are primarily gravitational, because it's so big. Its charge to mass ratio is infinitesimal compared to that of an electron. But there's a lot of electron movement because of the sun. Electrical activity. And so understanding this concept of charge to mass ratio is central to my work, because that helps you understand all of the movement of things out there. So the smaller dust particles move fast when they're being drawn into a comet nucleus relative to the comet nucleus. But collectively, they'll pull back on the comet nucleus and change its orbit. And the force there is electrical. But the electrical force is shielded. So you put all of these concepts together, and now you can start to understand how this stuff all functions in how regular astronomers out there think that everything is functioning by gravity, which 99.99% of the time it is. And only in very subtle situations do you see the electrical stuff. So that's kind of a summary of, and then you get back to the Birkeland currents. Obviously you see them there, but where's the source of energy that keeps these things lit up for millions of years?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. How does the universe run? Let's go back to, go back to fundamentals. We have more questions from listener Key to Enlightenment is asking, is gravity created by mass? This is what we've been told, isn't it? Gravity is created by mass, but I don't believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, the electron has a charge and it has mass. The proton, you know, and these are the building blocks. And the, you know, they build the atoms which build the molecules, and you can basically detect the proton mass all the way up to something the size of Earth. You could calculate, make an estimate, how many protons are in the Earth and how many electrons, you know, and it's neutral, essentially neutral, you could calculate the gravity of a proton and then do an integral over the entire Earth in electrons and come up with the mass of the Earth as a multiple of protons. So yeah, it's mass is a property, and the way Newton described it and the way Einstein described it is it's an inertial property. It's something, and we probably wouldn't really know much about gravity if the apple didn't fall and hit Newton on the head. It's a reaction based on something having mass. And then, of course, Galileo did the famous experiment where the little ball falls as fast as the big ball from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you know. And so there you get into the idea of there's a difference between force and mass. There's a much bigger force on the bigger object, but ultimately they fall at the same rate. But yeah, mass is a property of matter. And that's why they're having such a big struggle with dark matter and dark energy, because what they're seeing in the universe doesn't add up. The general relativistic equations and et cetera don't work. And so they keep adding other things to try and make them work. But yeah, mass is a matter, it's a property of matter.
And as you'd expect, really, yeah. Mass and matter coming from mater, from mother, you know, so it's the mother essence of the universe.
And even though the electron, like I was saying, you could add up all the protons in Earth and all the electrons and subatomic particles, and say there's this many protons in Earth, etc. Notice that Earth is electrically neutral, and all those charges that are in the protons and electrons all cancel out. So we're electrically neutral in those. But the mass still shines through as the sum of all the protons and all the electrons and all the masses of subatomic particles, etc. The mass works, and even though we have a shielded magnetic field around Earth, we have a shielding of our electric field of Earth, the gravity shines through all the way to Jupiter, to the other side of the universe.
So this is, people can say, well, how does astrology work? And you can say, well, gravity is instantaneous and infinite. And so that gives you, that actually gives quite a scientific explanation to astrology, because gravity, we're all affected by gravity in some ways. But do you think about the idea of psychism and of telepathy, mental telepathy and things like that could be an aspect of gravity, which is why we can't measure it electromagnetically?
Well, the other thing about electromagnetism is that if you have a change in the magnetic and electric fields, that does penetrate through these shields. And this is one of the very interesting things about, say, electromagnetic radiation. It can be changed or reflected or altered as it passes through the shielding. But the relative to telepathy, etc., it's more likely that those are electromagnetic related. When I was in the mid-1990s, I was working with some Russian scientists in Novosibirsk in Russia, and they were studying atmospheric electricity. Well, it turned out that some of the psychologists at the university started sitting in on the meetings, and they were translating my work, etc., and the psychologists wanted to understand, because they were studying, trying to get a scientific basis for astrology, exactly what you were talking about. And so what they realized is this alignment of the planets was not gravitational, because gravitationally the planets are weightless compared to each other when they're moving in this orbiting system. But they realized that the alignments caused electrical discharges between the planets, and they were measuring on unborn fetuses. They had the probes in, and they were measuring and trying to get reactions of when the planet crossings were, etc. And then they realized that when the baby was born, that all of the other senses kicked in, and all of these reactions to what we call astronomical alignments, as astrological alignments, were covered up. And a lot of people forget about them, but there's some people who still remain very much attuned to that. And those are the psychics. Those are the people who are really tuned to signaling, not only between planets, but between people. And if you look at what people are, we're a giant antenna. We're a big electromagnetic antenna, so we're signaling and we're able to receive. And most people lose that ability, because our eyes and our touch and our, we're hungry and we're mad and we have feelings, and all of this blocks. And the psychics are the ones that can shed all of that and get back to really those connections that we all have with the universe. And I believe that they're electromagnetic, because that's the one thing light and electromagnetic radiation does, move through these shieldings. And we have shieldings. I was in a room one time. I was taking some classes, we went in a room, and the teacher took us in there, and we all stood there in the dark for a long time. We kept our eyes open. Then we started looking, and we started seeing the auras and the chakras, etc., the other people. And I'd never seen this before. And I was, as a physicist, I was shocked. I was 50 years old when I saw this. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is bizarre. Because you could see the chakras of the other people, and the auras and the different shapes around the people. And then they say the different shaped auras mean different things. And I'm like, oh my God, this was so foreign to me as a scientist. But it's really true. So we are very connected, and unfortunately in this modern world, we're worried about the presidential election and, other things and the economy and, our job. And, so we've lost touch with this entire aspect of being human.
So in terms of, let's have a look. We got more questions, right? Have you heard of Sean David Morton?
Yes.
Right. He's written a book which is based on what I call black science, the workings of the inner deep space program and all of that stuff. On the cover, now this is a question from Moxie, on the cover, which I'm going to send to you right now on the as an image, on the cover is a formula, which reads S equals negative MGC, and that's epsilon DS from A to B. Now, to me, I don't know what that means. Can you see that image there?
Yeah? I'm looking, and nothing has come in here yet.
All right. If you look on the messaging, I'll see if I can send it onto the other box. Let me, I'll just send it twice here, so it'll come into your other Hold on, you see that now?
Yeah. Okay, let me get pop click up on there. That.
So I'll just cover it.
There we go. Okay.
So this is the cover.
Equal to MGC. So M would be like mass, G gravity, C is a big C is little C is the speed of light, but the big C I'm not sure. And then integral ds from A to B. Or is that an A? It's hard to see with this picture.
Yeah, that's A and B. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I just pulled it up. It's much clearer now. Okay. Okay. So, okay. And there's a negative out in front of the M there also. Mm-hmm. I see now. Okay. But, okay. So the question is, do I see some significance in that?
The question, I'll just ask the exact question for you. All right. So, can you look at the formula from the book and there and see if he gets anything out of it and can explain it? In fact, can you, does that make sense as a scientist and somebody who understands this language of science, and of mathematics? And, does that make sense to you?
Well, let me just go through all these terms. S would be a linear function. This has a one variable here. It appears that M, little g, and big C are constants.
Mm-hmm.
There's a negative sign in front of it, which we'll have to think about that. But big M would be, who knows, the mass of the sun or the mass of something. Little g typically is gravity. Big C, I'm not sure how I'd interpret that quite yet, but the integral is a line integral. ds is... S is typically used as the distance along a curve in space. So from A and the B is a little bit out of place there. If it's meant to be from A to B, the B should be backed by the integral sign. But it's basically a linear integral over some curve in space with respect to, and then with the constants and then the negative of that. So... but anyway, I don't have a interpretation offhand. I might have
all right.
Ask Sean about that and see if
yeah.
that was a something that was meant to be a. I do little puzzles on my books too, and let people kind of brain mess with their brains a little bit, it's kind of fun for an author. But yeah. I don't have it. An answer for you right now other than what I just said, you know, I'm just looking at the...
Right.
And the B at the end is kind of out of place.
Yeah, so I put it at the top, just above the D, but perhaps it was just to make it look balanced on the graphic. But what he says and what Sean has said is that I published the unified field theory on the front cover of my books and I've shown it to loads of physicists and nobody gets it. So that's, he got that from his notes. So
okay.
Perhaps he may have transcribed the notes wrong. There may be a little bit of misplacement. I'm sure the components are right, but they may be part of the puzzle is to sort out, you know, yes, that's a B in the wrong place because you know the language and you know that B shouldn't be beyond the DS but in front of the DS.
And it's also bigger than the A, so they would normally be the same size if it were related to the integral sign. Yeah, I mean, I taught calculus at all levels, engineering calculus and calculus of three dimensions and, you know, all the way up to tensor analysis. And so I'm familiar with these kind of things, but as understanding exactly what this is, it's a single dimensional integral. With from A and then the B, I don't quite understand those. But no, I can't tell you offhand. But it's interesting. Below is like a stick figure with what appears to be a chakra type of event going on there. And
he's falling through a time vortex.
Okay.
You see the, what he's alluding to is the old TV show, The Time Tunnel.
Yeah.
Do you remember the time tunnel? And that's the sands of time running out in the hourglass behind him. You see, in the sands of time are piled up in the hills behind him at the bottom. That's actually the bottom of it. An hourglass. Yeah. It's a large hourglass what you're looking at, or an egg timer.
Now I can see. Yeah.
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 So anyway, that was the question from Moxie. But yeah, it's always good to be able to say, well, does this mean anything to you? And maybe, you know, Sean has said that if you can figure this out, you can create a device like a mobile phone that can speak to anyone anywhere in the universe instantly with no delays.
So I won't be doing that this evening then.
So if you want a sort of winter hobby, there's something for you.
Okay.
Anyway, so let's go back to some more with a linear function on a curve with mass in it. Okay, so everybody else seems to be an expert on this. Let's find some more questions, because there's at least four vectors for questions that are coming in. I'm getting questions from Revolution Radio's main chat, some sub chats, some private chats. People are private messaging me on Skype, and I'm also getting through the Wolf Spirit Radio chat room. So please bear with me, everybody. I'm trying to get everybody's questions in, but it's great. I'm really enjoying this. So
it's great to see the reaction. Yes.
Yeah. Because we do, you know. All right. So here's the thing. It's from CC. Now you're talking about. He's saying, I think he is seeing, do you believe the sun is a fusion object, and why are sunspots dark?
Well, yes, the sun is fusion, and one thing I proved, that the fusion is up at the surface, it's up in the atmosphere, it's not in the core. And that's a whole story in itself, but these sunspots, when we look at the sun, they're all bright, but the sunspots are simply cooler, and it's an effect of the magnetism. They're magnetic regions, highly magnetic, and it tends to cool just like, say, clouds cool because the force that's keeping them together is a van der Waals force, and it tends to cool. Once the cloud starts to coalesce, the cloud begins to cool. And so it's a similar type of physics issue with the magnetic. There's a magnetic processes we use in cooling down to absolute zero, for example. The last stages are magnetic cooling. So anyway, but the sunspots are magnetically active regions, and sometimes related with solar storm activity. But basically the sun is a fusion object, and its fusion is kicked off by electrical activity in the atmosphere, by lightning bolts. And the way it works, the lightning, as you know, bends, and it takes sharp turns and following a path down through an atmosphere. And it's in those bends that the magnetic pressure gets high enough, and you have a very rich atmosphere of hydrogen and helium and deuterium and all of the, the lower fusionable species. And that's where it kicks off the fusion reaction. And part of the fusion reaction is the separation of charge. So it's like a self-perpetuating fusion of nuclear fire. And part of that, like I say, is the separation of charge, and that's what was never understood. And so the structure of the sun is a solid planetary core, which is cooler. I talk about the Russian experiment that shows that the sun's core is cooler. And then the fusion fire is going on, and the outer shell of what we call the sun is a positive charge, and that's surrounded by a sea of relativistic electrons. So the overall charge of the sun is actually negative on the surface. This is what you would see if you were outside of the sun. And then when these explosions occur, the protons that fire up from the sun in the explosion, some go down, some go up, they see that screen of electrons, and they're accelerated towards it as if it were like a screen mesh. And as there's enough momentum that they literally blast through that screen, and that's what accelerates them out into the wider solar system. So that's where the solar wind comes from, and that's why there's an excess of protons in the solar wind, which carries all the way out beyond Pluto, the orbit of Pluto in all directions and creates the solar capacitor. So that's kind of the rudimentary model of the sun.
So James, is it, what I'm looking at is like a fermionic valve, like the radio valve that you have in your Marshall amplifiers, is a kind of small scale model of the same thing that you were just talking about. Is that correct?
I'll say that again. You're talking about the old tubes?
Yeah, tube valve. Yeah, we call them, in Britain we call them valves. In America you call them tubes.
Tubes, yeah.
Yeah. So you have what you call a tube amp, right? And there's a hot thing in the middle and it's accelerating electrons towards the, thing that are amplified by the charge on the anode that then accelerates them towards the cathode at the other end. I've got that around the wrong way, haven't I? Got the anode, the anode is at the back end, yeah.
But the sun works actually the opposite. And the anode is out beyond Pluto. And the sun itself is negatively, so it's the idea that the sun is an anode is backwards.
Okay, so it's the other way around.
The reason you can tell that is because if the sun were the anode, then the comet tails would point towards the sun. And because of the way the electron, remember I said the electrons are invisible, but they're the majority of the charge carrier. And the positive part is the comet tail with its coming into the negatively charged nucleus. Well, if the sun were the anode positively charged, then the tail of the comet would point towards the sun. And it doesn't. It points away from the sun. So that's proof that the sun itself is not the anode. But anyway, that's the simple model there. So we have a center core positively charged of the sun. That's the outer atmosphere. The corona is negatively charged relativistic electrons that are held there by the electric field of the proton. So it's a superatom. And by the way, that is what ball lightning is. The way you create ball lightning is you have an atmosphere of basically water. And when the electrical discharge comes through, it separates the water into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen goes away and the hydrogen breaks apart and becomes a superatom. It becomes basically a large fusion atom about the size maybe of a basketball. And so you have the protons whose relativistic motion keeps it bound, and then the electrons are on the outside. So it's the same model for what the sun is doing.
That sounds like great fun. I'll tell you. So you know what? I'm not your usual radio host. The other week, I was strolling around eBay, as you do, and I saw a 3.6 volt to 400 kilovolt boost amplifier. And I thought, I'll have to buy one of those because it's only like $4. Unbelievable. It's for making plasma sparks. So it didn't last long because they're quite fragile, I've discovered. But, the great fun is to create lightning in your own kitchen with the battery. It's just an absolute, it's a real buzz, quite literally. Of course I did eventually tase myself, and that was quite fun, but, I've gotten over that. Cause you're talking about lightning and there it is in my own kitchen, and it's not going straight from A to B. Actually, what I really wanted to do, James, is to create those things that they had in the monster movies, the thing that with the spark that went.
Oh, yeah. They called Jacob's Ladder.
Then. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to make one of those.
It rides up and then, you know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I'd have.
Laboratory.
Exactly.
I love those movies with who was that? Wilder, what's his name?
Gene Wilder. Oh, yes. Young Frankenstein.
Gene Wilder in the Frankenstein comedy. That was, and then they had the Igor, the assistant there. And,
that's right. That was Marty Feldman, one of the most creative British comedians ever. He invented Monty Python. All the Monty Python scripts were written for him. And, eventually one day, you know, just this, like, he's not a bit part player. He's a really important actor. One day he just threw them away. I got new script writers and all of those scripts then became Monty Python, what we know as Monty Python, or all his rejected scripts.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So there you go.
That's he was fantastic.
So meanwhile, at 400 kilovolts, it's still not enough to make a really great big spark. So I've just bought, and I blew it up, of course. So I bought another one for £5, and that one's going to be 1,000 kilovolts. So that's a megavolt running off a tiny little battery. It's quite an amazing thing, and you can create quite a large sort of spark with it. And I'm sure you've made equipment like this or worked with equipment like this in the past. It's really noisy for a start. What's the deal? How come lightning travels in a non-straight manner? Why does it zigzag? Why does it ziggurat? What's the deal there?
Well, yeah, it's what happens first is the leading strike comes out and finds a path. And so that breaks down and ionizes the air. And then that's eventually the path that the big current follows, the major. So you'll find this little lead lightning, and for some reason, it bends and it goes from here to there, and I don't know if there's a good explanation other than one of those randomness vortex type things of nature. Some lightning goes straight, like there'll be some that goes boom from cloud to ground, but remember the standard story of lightning in the cloud is that somehow the electricity is formed inside the cloud, which is totally false. The cloud is a conductor, and the electric field inside the cloud is very near zero. The cloud is simply the transfer mechanism from the ionosphere down to ground. So the electricity is coming around the cloud and around to the bottom and then down. And that's why on, say, a hurricane, you'll find the majority of lightning on the leading edge of the hurricane, because that's the first edge that's finding something to discharge to. It's part of a much bigger circuit. So the electricity is not formed in the cloud, or one of my favorite is volcanic lightning above volcanoes. There's wonderful, wonderful pictures all over the internet. I was at a scientific meeting one time, and a bunch of grad students, it was American Geophysical Union meeting, so there were a bunch of grad students getting around my presentation. It was like a poster. It's very common to have a poster presentation at those meetings. So I had this group of graduate students, and they're talking to me, and I'm explaining that the atmospheric lightning is coming from the ionosphere. And this professor of theirs comes up, and he's very mad because his belief is that it's formed in the volcanic plume itself. And I said, well, no, because it's outside. It's coming. If that were the case, it would be internal to the plume, and it would never leave. And all this lightning is on the outside, you know. And so anyway, he was trying to argue that, and one of his students piped up, and he said, no, McCanny's right. If the lightning were created inside, it would never leave, and then we're seeing all this outside. And that poor student got roasted, and that guy took all his students and made them walk away. It was pretty interesting. But one of the students, I don't know if he got his PhD or not, but he probably got a bit of a tongue lashing after that day. But yeah, the electricity is coming from the wider scale electric current that comes from the ionosphere, and that is funded, so to speak, from the electric currents that are passing by Earth, which are funded in turn by the discharge of the solar capacitor.
And is there a... All right, so, all right, AC or DC?
Primarily DC, but there are waves within waves. And so when these currents move and turn, then you get AC components. But primarily, it's direct current. These discharges are like the bug in the backyard bug killer thing, where the bug is flying through the screens. You would call that a direct current, although it's as it's changing, that's an alternating or variable current. But primarily, it's DC. It's going in one direction along a certain line, And in a sense, you'd probably call that DC.
All right. So, yeah, or a pulsed DC. So these things are, the universe is a series of pulse, what's that word? Store and forward, really. If yeah. You're talking on a network, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, all interconnected. And once again, you can listen to the radiation. A lot of the electric noise, like Jupiter, is very electrically active, very noisy, electrically. And that's because it is involved in that fusion process. If you look at a picture, this is a great, I've got some pictures on my webpage of Jupiter in the infrared. And the great red spot is highly active in the infrared. In a lot of the bands, and you see these, especially the cyclonic storms, are very active in the infrared. And that's because that's where a lot of the lightning is, and so therefore a lot of the fusion. And so it varies. And if Jupiter were just this ball of gas, gravitationally bound, you would have a nice uniform infrared signature over the surface of Jupiter. But you can see that it's related to the fusion activity.
So tell us about this red spot. How come it just keeps going? Is it a, well, I mean, do we know what's, has anyone gone down? Is there anything solid in, you know, we know it's a gas giant. We say, or we're told that it's a gas giant, but you're saying it's a star. Is a star, what? Oh, sorry. I've got a million questions about Jupiter. It's the most beautiful thing for a star.
Yes.
And, the latest pictures from NASA are just like, ah, wow. And it's all sort of, I mean, in a way, I wouldn't want to live there. It looks nice, no. But if I was down there, it would be pretty smoggy. And what would be going on if I was to stand anywhere near what could be represented as something that was surface-like, in the red spot? What would be this, you know, what would be, what, I'm trying to use words like on the ground there, but you know, is there something that, is there frozen gas down in the densest layers or what?
Well, it would because of the pressure down there, it's going to be perfectly spherical. Or as very close to spherical as possible. Certainly not mountains, but the thing that, let's go to Earth here, the hurricanes or the typhoons we have on Earth, they break up when they hit land. And the old story is that they hit land and it stops the wind, but the real story is that they short out electrically when they hit the land. And that's part of the formative process of a hurricane is it's a vertical electric field. The ionized air around the surface of the ocean finds a path up through the cloud to the ionosphere. And as it goes up, this column of air rotates like water going down a bathtub goes into a vortex. And so anyway, that's a hurricane. So the great red spot on Jupiter is a hurricane, but there's no land mass there to short out. So it just keeps going around and around and around. And they've seen other spots on Jupiter eaten up by the great red spot. They combine. Sometimes they pass by one another, do this little dance. And so at any rate, there's nothing to short out the storm. So it just keeps going and going and going, like the ever-ready bunny. But on Earth, you have these land masses. We just had an interesting case of a hurricane that crossed Central America and restarted. It had enough energy to restart when it got over to the Pacific. Very rare instance, but not impossible. But what happens to a hurricane is it shorts out when it hits land, and that's why you have all the tornadoes on the leading side of a hurricane when it hits land, is because that electrical current is also forming the tornadoes. And so tornadoes are very much associated with electricity.
So is it the spot? Sorry, Jim. Is it the connection between? So all right. So we got a highly charged Earth lump, and then we have an ionic connection between the ionosphere and that, but is caused by some cloud just wandering around one day and just getting in the right, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and causing a discharge between the Earth and the ionosphere that somehow then keeps going in a spiral fashion, and then that creates the spiral vortex around which the tornado is created. Is that what's going on? Or there's also the there's also the hurricane forming theory of the falling air and the rising air that gets spun around, that starts spinning on a horizontal way, but then suddenly tip up. Could this be the trigger for the things tipping up?
Well,
if that's the right, what is the model of hurricanes and tornadoes?
Well, I've watched hundreds of hurricanes form from satellite images, etc. And what typically happens is as these cumulonimbus clouds, thunder clouds we call them, are boiling up, it's typically the very tippity top one, the very highest one, where the eye starts to form. And they, because that's like a finger sticking up there, and that's where the current wants to go to. And so the current starts working its way down through the cloud, and it's the ionized part is at the ocean sea level. And so what happens is it starts an electrical current moving up that same column. And as it does, it starts to rotate, and it kind of, in a sense, drills out that spiral hole and clears out. And as it comes up, a lot of the air condenses and spills out over the side. And that's where you see the outer cloud tops on a hurricane from the satellite images. But the reality with a hurricane, you have a low pressure cell, you know, 9 millibars or something like that, or below 10. And the wind is coming into this low pressure cell at 150 miles an hour from all sides. How does this low pressure cell maintain for more than a minute? Well, that's because the air is moving up this column, and it's just part of an electrical circuit. And that's why on Earth, the hurricanes and the typhoons move west, because it's the right-hand rule. It's the current, positive current going up the tube. The magnetic field is north. That's your first finger sticking out, and the force is in the left direction when you're looking north. That's why the hurricanes move west. It's there. It's a magnetic force. It's electrical current in a magnetic field, and it makes it move west. And then when they start to break up, they can veer north, and the electrical currents just follow. They get up in the other jet stream, and then that drags them easterly once they get up far enough north. Then the hurricanes are dragged along in that northerly jet stream in an easterly direction. Some of them make it all the way to England. You've had a few hurricanes move in there that have come all the way from across the, from Africa west out into the Indies, and then north and all the way to where you are up there.
It was a nice big round trip. World tour. Great.
Yes.
Great stuff. Spinning tops and their backing band. And right. So we've got about 10 minutes left. It's really whizzed by at astronomical speeds. I want to see if, let's see, there's more. Oh, that's interesting. All right. So, there's a question from Jeff in Vilnius. He's wondering, why do people talk about ices on the outer planet as opposed to the rocky inner planets? Isn't rock simply mineral ice, and isn't the ice on Pluto, etc., simply solid forms of what's a gas on Earth? And if that distinction is false, why does the phrase dirty snowball not apply to comets?
Well, the definition from the 1950s, it was called the ice ball model. Then it was called the snowball model, and then when they realized there was a bit more dirt in there, they called it the dirty snowball comet model. But the concept behind that is that it's a ball of ice or snow that sublimates when it gets near the sun, and that's what causes the tail. So yes, there are tons and tons of objects in outer space that are icy. But something that has no ice at all in the form of water ice or carbon dioxide or what we call volatiles on Earth. And that's correct. You know, what, you know, in a volcano, rock can become molten and liquid and vaporize. So it's certainly a state of, temperature and a state of matter, and certainly a relative term as to whether something's a gas or a liquid, or a vapor or solid or whatever. But the classical definition of dirty snowball comet is that it melts and that's where the tail comes from. And that's not true. The reality is that it's discharging the solar capacitor and the tail material is moving in towards the nucleus. And one of the big mistakes standard astronomers have made is that they've put satellites out in the tail region of a comet and they see what are called neutrals coming into the, from the comet nucleus. So these ionized materials come into the comet nucleus, they become neutralized because there's a sea of electrons there, and then they float out in the solar wind because they're no longer electrical. So they float out in the solar wind, and that convinced scientists that their dirty snowball comet model was correct. The only problem is there's not many of them that float out in the solar wind. And so a lot of the things don't add up, but that's why scientists have been fooled. But they see the electric fields, they see the changing magnetic fields all the way back to the very first satellites that got to a comet were Giacobini-Zinner back in the 1980s. And they detected all kinds of things, electromagnetic conditions, etc., and didn't understand what they were seeing. So, they could have discovered X-rays in comets, but they turned the X-ray detectors off on that satellite, something I told them not to do. This guy, James Farquhar, was the head of that project. And I told him, don't turn off the X-ray detectors because you can detect X-rays on comets. So he called up the guys at NASA and they laughed at him. They said, no. If you want to save power, the first thing you turn off is the X-ray detector because there can't be X-rays in comets. And it was 10 years later that they, in fact, discovered X-rays and comets, one of my main predictions. So anyway, that's a little bit longer answer. But, yeah, traditionally the dirty snowball comet model relates to ices melting off, sublimating off the nucleus and creating the tail, and that's simply not what's going on. They just landed on the 67P, the Rosetta mission, not a drop of ice. There was not a drop of ice or carbon dioxide. They measured a bunch of organic molecules piled up high on the nucleus, but not a drop of ice and nothing coming off the nucleus.
So the cometary tail is formed completely from material that is in the solar wind already.
Yes. It's coming in. It's being drawn in from the space. I mean, it's like a cosmic vacuum cleaner. That's a term I've used. That it's electrical cosmic vacuum cleaner. That's the electron beam is hitting the nucleus, charges up the nucleus negatively, so it's drawing all this positively charged material in that moves much slower. And remember that the electron beam is the majority charge carrier, and so it's always has plenty of negative charge at the nucleus to draw in the positive charged material, and if the nucleus is big enough, a lot of it can start to stick and grow. If it's not gravitationally large, a lot of that material blows back out in the solar wind and it doesn't grow. Oh my goodness.
Dr. James McKenney, thank you very much for joining me on this particular journey. It's been fascinating. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
And happy holidays, everybody. Good night.